We are a people who are subject to the ravages of sin. And that's what we're just talking about. We age, we get sick, our bodies decay, and we die because Adam brought sin into the world, and we, each and every one of us, on numerous occasions, have thought that was a pretty good idea. So we choose to participate in it as well, and we bring upon ourselves all the corrupting, degrading, and eventually destructive effects of that sin. And we assemble on the first day of the week, those our God has asked us to do, having been cleansed, washed of those sins in the blood of Jesus the Christ. We come together then to study His Word, to worship and glorify Him, all in the hope that He will be well pleased when He looks down from heaven upon seeing children of His who are striving to be like Him as Jesus manifested that perfection in this life, doing all that we can to demonstrate that this is not just an academic exercise for us, but we live our lives out of the deepest appreciation for the price that has been paid to redeem us from those sins. So each and every one of you is great encouragement being here this morning, waging war against Satan. So often we have those military examples, and we appreciate them. Seeing in significant numbers those that are in a part of that army coming together to perfect their skills in this great battle for the eternal future of each and every one of us. We have been, in the last couple of weeks, continuing in our study of what has long been recognized as these five great discourses in Matthew. Now, there's much of Jesus preaching and teaching and miracle working, of course, examples that He sets with regard to righteousness throughout the Gospel that are in addition to these. But chapters 5 through 7, of course, on the Sermon on the Mount, three chapters, very large amount of information that He presented to the Jews of His day in preparation for a coming kingdom. Chapter 10, which we're studying right now, so please open to Matthew 10, is a very specific, though, not material that's designed for general consumption. And He has singled out 12 men. He is assigning to them their first journey, their first missionary efforts apart from Him. He is sending them out on their own to be preaching and teaching and to face the consequences thereof, which is great resistance. And so He is preparing His apostles for an even greater and longer work, which will come after Jesus returns to reign from heaven. But until then, this 10th chapter, is there as preparatory information very specifically for them. Then in verse 13, we again, for general consumption, have an entire chapter that's devoted to the parables. It's a chapter of parables, a sermon in parables, again, for general consumption. Chapter 18 as well, dealing with attitudes in the kingdom, what kind of people we ought to be, again, for very general consumption, as are these last three chapters, 23, 24, and 25, although these chapters speak of a coming judgment, as we saw introduced in our lesson last week, and we'll be thinking about that again this morning, a judgment that will fall upon the people of the generation, those people who rejected their Messiah. The material that's often misunderstood to speak about the end of the world itself says that all these things will take place in this generation. So Jesus put a very recognizable, very clear time stamp on that material. And that material would take place while those people that were yet living, still most of them living, after He left this earth, would see this judgment come. So we'll have more on that this morning and then again to come, because that theme of a coming judgment upon the people who rejected their Messiah is woven throughout the entirety, really, of the Gospel of Matthew. So what we've seen so far is, again, we think about material that's really not directed at us. It's very easy to mistake that. It's very easy to forget that and jump on into material, in Matthew 10 and other places. It is clearly limited to the apostles, can only be applicable to the apostles, and then we just kind of appropriate it for ourselves. Jesus will, next week, turn His attention to what these men are to be preaching. So we will be seeing material starting next week that is for that general consumption. It's for all people, to learn and prosper from. But in the preceding two lessons, and again today, you know, let's not forget that this is Jesus telling apostles how to perform their particular responsibilities, and therefore material that is not being directed at us. We're not apostles. So we have seen that they are to go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. They were expressly forbidden to go to the Gentiles, though we work with Gentiles every day. They were expressly forbidden to go to the Samaritans, though none of us have ever met one, probably. We would, of course, present the gospel to those people of long ago if we just could meet one. But they were to go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. They were to preach that the kingdom was at hand, that it was near, that it was coming. We're a part of that kingdom. We're looking back on its establishment nearly two millenniums ago. They were to freely give what had been given to them. Immense, incalculable power. Power to heal every disease. Power even to raise those who had been killed by those diseases. Power to impact not just this earth, but the demons, and to cast them out. These are powers that none of us have ever seen. These are powers that have not existed since the first century. These are powers that are specifically stated to end there in the first century. These are apostolic powers. Certainly they're not ours. They were to also manifest a tremendous faith. They were not to prepare for this journey. They were not to, have an extra set of clothes or shoes. They were not to take weaponry. They were to be utterly dependent upon their God and the people to whom they went. So it took a degree of faith, particularly for them, that is astonishing to us. We all have jobs, or hope that we will soon. We all have these kinds of responsibilities, blessed as we are in the United States, but they were all quite forbidden to these men entirely. Then, in verses 16 through 23, the material we studied last week, we saw that they were going to be persecuted, and they better get ready for it. Jesus makes it extremely plain. You are not going to be well received much of the time. You are going to be hounded and persecuted even to the death. You're going to be beaten and abused. So get used to that, because that is certainly coming for you. Now, brother, most of us have never experienced anything like that. Now, once again, I think this goes, directly to the times and to the mission of those apostles. I will say I have, in fact, received two death threats in my lifetime that I reported to the police. I took them to be, that serious. But most of us never even get that far into it. And I happen to be writing, articles in a paper, so I was more prominent, became something of a target. But, nobody ever broke a window in my house. Even, nobody's ever done me any real damage. I've had a fair amount of slander, that's been offered. And you have too, but the persecution that was coming for them was unavoidable. The persecution that was coming to them was to the death. And we'll see a reason for that here in the material we'll be talking about in just a moment. But what is also very important for us to remember, brethren, is that terminology about the coming of the Son of Man in the Gospel of Matthew is about the coming judgment on the Jews, and most particularly, therefore, in Israel, and then the coming down of the temple that is going to happen in that generation. So last week we saw the direct parallels in Matthew 10 to Matthew 24, that these things must take place in this generation. We'll see that again in just a moment this morning. So let's tie in what we've seen already, the last couple of verses of Jesus very exclusively preparing apostles for their mission and in their age, with Matthew chapter 10, verses 22 and 23, which I have on the screen for you there. You, he says, will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. Now, I pointed this out last week. I pointed it out in other classes. I know if you're new to us, this will sound very strange and just, amazing and impossible. But we've been conducting very close Bible studies, seeing how the terms were used and understood by those people, not how they're popularly understood today. So this endure to the end will be saved is an expression that is also used in Matthew 24 prior to the verse which says, all these things will come upon this generation. This salvation here is not salvation from sin. It is salvation from physical death. When in Matthew 24, especially built on 23 and going on into chapter 25, where Jesus is warning them that when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you need to flee into the Judean hillside lest you be killed. They will be enduring this persecution for the next 40 years. They must still yet steel themselves to take not one step backward, even to the point of death. They are to endure. Now, some of them will be killed. Those that are still living 40 years from now in Jerusalem and in Israel will be given signs by which they can flee that country in order to avoid the Roman invasion, which Jesus describes as his coming upon those people in judgment. So we talked about that last week. You'll see it again in a little moment. So I want to tie, you know, this back together again. We just leap, you know, to every time we see the word saved or salvation, to a spiritual thought about from sin, when many times in the context that's not the case at all. Not a special word that has to do with forgiveness. You know, if you saved your money, you use that word sozo. If you saved, you know, somebody from a lion attack, you'd use that word. It's used salvation from sin as well, but only the context determines. So he says, next verse, whenever they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. For truly I say to you, you apostles, nobody else, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. There were more towns, villages, cities, you know, in just that little country than those 12 men could preach in the next 40 years before the Son of Man would come. So that's a profoundly important time stamp. He told them they wouldn't finish their preaching even in Israel before the Son of Man came. We're talking then about a coming that was in that generation that the apostles would live to see. But we're going to now turn to the new material in Matthew 10 and verse 24. Now, see the connections, though, is what I'm hoping for this morning, how these thoughts are tied together. So, you're going to be hated. Endure it all the way to the end. You'll be saved. But when they persecute you in one city, you flee to the next. You won't finish the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. That's just never the case. Now, what Jesus is telling these 12 men, I'm the master. You are the slaves. Don't think for a minute that you are going to be treated any better than I am. Don't think for a minute that you are any better than I am. Don't think that you can escape what I'm currently enduring. He's telling these men, get ready. You are not above me. You are my disciples. You are my slaves. If I can't escape these things, neither can you. That's the point of verse 25. It is enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher. And this is called an ellipsis where something's left out, but it's implied and you know what it is. So for a second time he's saying, it's enough for the slave that he be like his master. So let's read that sentence again. Both times it's enough. It's enough for the disciple that he become like his teacher and the slave like his master. Jesus means in absolutely every way. And they hate me. They will persecute me. They will torture me. They will kill me. And then I'm coming back from the dead to encourage you men to understand that you're not above me. You're not exempt from the things that I've experienced. And if you will devote yourself to my teachings, if you will become as much like me as you possibly can, if you are just like your teacher, your master, then you'll get what I got. If they called the head of the house Beelzebul, a common term that's meant as the greatest of all insults, a satanically oriented idol, you know, Beelzebub, Beelzebul, you'll see in some translations, Beelzebub, Lord of the Flies, how much more will they malign his household? You are not sinlessly pure. You are not divinely wise. You are not merely what I, as the Son of the Living God, an eternal being now come, you know, the very representation of God, Emmanuel, God with us, you are not the Lord. It's enough if you just strive with everything that is in you, you 12 men, you try to become like me. And if you do, and see how they treated me, then at least that much is coming for you, and perhaps even more. Now, brother, we, all of us, I think, and rightly so, of course, we read all the biblical characters, and we try to think of putting ourselves in their shoes and living the lives that they did, having that kind of faith and courage, you know, and great adventures and all to the glory of God, with magnificent success and tens of thousands, you know, coming to Christ, changing the course of the world's entire history and enduring to this day in a kingdom, in a church that can never be destroyed, as prophesied by Daniel, you know, an eternal kingdom. And so we thrill to these stories. We think about those individual people who lived in those times. But brethren, you wouldn't want to be one of them. For sure. It's enough that you become like your teacher, and if you do, then they'll attribute your powers to demons and to Satan. And then, if you're his disciple, lacking his purity, his wisdom, and his power, you're going to be treated even worse than he did. Precisely because you lack his purity, his wisdom, and his power. So do the best you can to be the living image of Jesus Christ, the Lord on earth. But you're going to fall short of it, and they'll treat you worse for it. So, brethren, had I been living in those times, I would have been as excited as anybody else, and you would have been too. And it would have been sorely tempting. You know, I wish the Lord had picked me. And great things are coming. And you can see those apostles. Oh, we're going to be high in the kingdom. Who's going to be the greatest? They're missing the whole point. They're thinking about power and glory and peace and wealth and all these wonderful, great, and good things. And Jesus is saying, no, 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 no. You guys have got it all wrong. So had we been living in those days, brethren, and had we been thinking about trying to fill those shoes, any one of us in his right mind would have understood what I think these apostles should have somehow gotten an inkling of. You will pay the highest price for this great honor. You will suffer for this. And you better get ready, because it's coming for you personally, each and every one. This leads us now at 26 and 27, where he says, therefore. And brethren, this is probably the heart of all this material in chapter 10. Jesus is trying to prevent fear in the 12. Fear is tremendously powerful, and fear is awfully influential in defeating anyone who feels it. When you're afraid, you're hesitant. When you're afraid, you're likely more interested in trying to hide and avoid than you are in stepping up to a place of prominence and facing squarely whatever comes back at you. So in 26, he tells these 12, do not fear them, for nothing is concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. Now what he's saying, brethren, and we'll see this in the preceding material, those weeks we've already had, and into, you know, what follows as well, what he's saying is, there's judgment coming. You're going to be horribly mistreated, worse than I, Jesus, have been. But do not fear, because it will be known in judgment, and they will pay in judgment. And you have been commissioned by me to try to turn people from that judgment, to rescue people from this. to call them into godly service, to call them into unparalleled wisdom and understanding, to call them into purity and righteousness. You 12, if you turn yellow on me, if you get weak-kneed, if you go wobbly, who's going to call these people? Who's going to save these people? Who's going to teach them how to endure in faith even when your world is crashing down about you? Do not fear, for nothing is concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. They will not get away with it. You've got to stand up to it until their judgment comes. So, what I tell you in darkness. Now, that's the part I would have liked. Now, you all well know I've been to Israel 4 times. I'm planning a 5th time. If you ever wanted to go to Israel, please come talk to me. I'll be there in the last part of October, first part of November. Be happy to have you tag along. We'll go and, you know, and look at these places. And when you're there especially, you get, you know, called to fill in those sandals. And you think about campfires at night. 13 men. Think about Jesus saying these wondrous things. Often very confusing, but sometimes so enticing, so encouraging, so empowering. You think about hours and hours and hours in darkness that they had sat and listened to their Lord. But he said, when I tell you in darkness, you got to speak in the light. You can't hide. You're going to be prominent. You're going to be out there. Step up. And what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. We're going public, boys, and you're going to lead the charge. That's what Jesus is saying. It's time to start advertising. We're going to be headlines. We're going to be a big deal. We're going to change the entire world. And that's shortly after they murder me and plan worse for you. So get yourselves ready. Get your mind in order. Plant your feet. Stiffen your back. Square your shoulders, because I'm giving you full disclosure, you 12. And you know what? They stepped up. The book of Acts is all about that, isn't it? We have epistles that are all about it. Now, brethren, this is personal for the apostles. We're not apostles. But we are taught to follow their examples, aren't we? We are taught to be anxious for nothing in the Philippian letter. We are taught to be courageous. We are taught that while probably you and I will never experience anything closely akin to what they went through, still yet, we too, in our time and place, are the light of the world, the salt of the earth, the city that cannot be hidden, which he'd been preaching since the Sermon on the Mount, for everybody to understand. If you're going to be a disciple of the Lord, apostle or not, you're going to be in the public eye as a representation of the Lord Jesus Christ. And then, brethren, comes the hard part. Now, I've been preparing for this, you know, taught in several other classes and everything. So for those of you that haven't been here in all the rest of those classes, I know this is kind of tough, comes as a shock, you know, and it's okay. But again, I'm just, let me lay out some scriptures to help us understand something that just almost is universally misunderstood because it is ripped out of context. It is torn away from those people, those times. And then it is forced to be directed at us, which it wasn't. So when we, you know, tear something out of its context, try to apply it today, we're likely to make some pretty serious mistakes. Now please, everybody, I'm not going to put this verse on the screen, so look at your Bible in verse 28. Do not fear those who kill the body. He told 12 men when he sent them out on an exclusive mission to Jews and nobody else, with the powers to raise the dead and every other miracle you can imagine, and the world's persecution about to fall on their heads for it. Do not fear. That's what he said in 26. Do not fear those who kill the body but are unable to kill. Now, I'm going to ask for a show of hands. In any given audience, there's going to be quite a range of translations. I never miss a chance to say the best translation, in my opinion, you can buy today is a New American Standard Bible. Get one. They're cheap online on eBay. Get a New American Standard. It's the best translation available today. Closely followed by the New King James. So if you already bought the New King James, don't change anything. Okay? But brethren, we need to understand the terms. So give me a show of hands. How many of you have in verse 28 anything other than soul after unable to kill? Is there a single translation that has anything other than soul? You'll note there's not one hand raised. So it was not much of a show, was it? Now, universally, everybody translates this word soul. Now, I ask you, in the Greek of the first century, what did that term mean to them? Now, I know what you think it means. That's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, when Jesus told 12 Jews 2,000 years ago, he told it to them in a language they fully understood. He used a word there. And he said, you are not to be afraid of those who kill the body, but cannot kill the something in Greek. And you probably don't even know what the word is. Very rare is it, brethren, any of my Greek studies pay off. I don't encourage anybody to go study Greek like I did. But every so often it does help. And in most people's cases today, you know, you can go online for free. You can find out what that word is. I'll tell you in a minute. But when you do, you still have to understand what did it mean to them. So let's just let that lie for a second. I know what you think when you hear in contemporary English the word soul. What did they think it meant? Continue the verse. Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul. But rather, fear him who is able to destroy, is the word, understood in every language the same way, to destroy both soul and body in hell. How many have anything other than hell? Anybody? Please. Who has something other than hell? Okay. And again, nobody. So that's the way it gets translated. Now, what do you think hell means? I know exactly what you think hell means. But that's, you know, not the question. The question is, what's the word and what did it mean to them then in their language and culture? Now, I'm going to tell you this second one right now. The word is Gehenna. It doesn't appear a whole lot in Scripture. But brethren, there isn't any doubt about it. What that word means is the Valley of Hinnom that's on the east and the south side, because it does a dog leg of the old city of Jerusalem in that day. Now, whatever you think about soul and whatever you think about hell, know this, that there are those who can kill the body, but they cannot kill the soul. So you better be afraid of God, because he does both. Both. He does both. He destroys them both, the body and the soul, in the Valley of Hinnom, in Gehenna. That's what that word meant to them then. It did not mean an eternity living eternally in a tormented body burned in flames. Didn't mean that to them at all. I've walked through that valley a couple of times. That's what they were thinking. It's not what we think anymore, because in our culture, this hell has a totally different idea attached to it. But it's not what it hit them. Now please just get this in 10:28. Just know what he said. He said, God destroys the soul in Gehenna. That's what you need to be afraid of. So, don't fear anything people can do. Only God can do that. Now, you see, I've got, in comparison to this, Matthew 16, verses 25 through 28 over there. Here they are, and again, we did this in a preceding class. Whoever wishes to save his life. Please open, everybody, 16, 25 in Matthew, just a few pages away. How many people have life? Raise your hand if 1625 uses the word life twice. Okay, everybody turn, Matthew 16. Look at verse 25. Whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake shall find it. Now, just for fun, raise your hand if you have life. Okay, that's going to be everybody, isn't it? Raise your hand if you don't have life. It's uniform, isn't it? Okay, now read on. 26. What will a man be profited if he gains the whole world and forfeits his... How many have soul? Put your hand up for soul. Put your hand down. Now put it up if you got something other than soul. Okay? Bill, go to your room. Bill's got a different word. But don't say anything yet. Okay? So then we got 27. Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with the angels, and will then recompense every man according to his deeds. All that's on the board. What I didn't put up yet is the next statement in 28. Some of those standing here will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Oh, the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father. That's identical to come in his kingdom. And some of you standing here will not die before it happens. You won't even finish the cities of Israel before it happens. Now, if that's jarring to you, welcome to the good old U.S. of A., where we've always been raised to believe that these passages are about a future judgment that has not happened yet. But God keeps going, timestamp, 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 timestamp. And he says, they're going to happen before all of you guys die. They're going to happen, all of them, in this generation. We need to start reading and believing what the verses say, rather than imposing upon them something they didn't. Now, those of you that have been through this before with me, we've done Matthew 16. Now I'm adding Matthew 10:28. In Matthew 10:28, the word for soul is psyche. It's the word we get psyche out of, psychiatry out of. And that's the word used here for life in Matthew 16, 25, twice. And it's the identical same word that's now translated soul in the next verses in Matthew 16. And that's why in America we don't understand at all what went on in their minds. Because denominational doctrines, which have been taught in America for well over 200 years, believe that these passages were talking about the end of the world when they weren't. So, when they had a problem, if we say whoever wishes to save his soul will lose it, whoever loses his soul for my sake will find it, well, that makes no sense. Souls are eternal, aren't they? So we don't put soul, we put life, the translator said. And then, though, we do think he's thinking about the end of the world, though, so what would you exchange for your eternal soul? And they use two different words when it's one and the same word in Matthew 16, and it's the same word you have over here. And it has to do with your being alive, your spirit, your psyche, your consciousness. Both of which are destroyed in Gehenna if you're an apostle listening to Jesus. So let's just say we need to think about this, don't we? We will in future lessons. But know this, in every Greek text, the same word in Greek is used all five times. And yet it's translated two different ways that mean totally different things to us in America today. So, let me suggest to you, life is the far better translation. And let's be consistent, even if the translators aren't, and use the same English word for the identical Greek word that's used four times in Matthew 16 and used over here. So, whatever you think about souls, they get destroyed in Gehenna. If you think your life is destroyed as well as your body, then you're believing what God said through Jesus in Matthew 10:28. So then, I'll just leave it with you to think about it. This is how we would spell in English the word, P-S-Y-C-H-E, psyche. Okay, but we need to close now, verses 29 through 31. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father, but the very heads of your hairs of your head are all numbered. So, for the third time, what did he say? Do not fear. You 12 men, are more valuable than many sparrows. So if you want to preserve your body, that's soma in Greek, we have somatic today, psychosomatic, in fact, comes from those two words put together. But if you want to keep your body and your psyche, whatever ideas you attach to it, from being destroyed in that valley on the west and south of Jerusalem in this generation, then know that you're more valuable in the sight of your God. And fear not, fear not, fear not. You're going to get wrecked. Take it on the chin. Never turn away, you 12. Because all the world's depending on you in Israel and not the Jews and not the Samaritans in this mission. Okay? Now, brother, if you're confused, good. Stay that way. Okay? We're building. And the purpose of all these lessons and these discourses is to see. In the end, when you see everything Jesus said, it made perfect sense to them, and it will to you too. Stick with me. If you are looking to become a Christian this morning, if you've been studying are ready to respond to that gospel, we certainly hope you will, right here and right now. If you're in need of prayer, if you're needing a private Bible study, if you just need help on something, anything, let me know and please come and speak with me as we stand and sing.